This is Judy Maxwell. Life can happen in an instant. Sometimes you plan for it, like retirement or taking care of your family. Sometimes it's a surprise, like a winter storm with home or property damage. Sometimes it may be an unexpected accident or illness or even a premature death. Whatever life throws at you, you'll wish you had gotten the right insurance when you had the chance. That's where Maxwell Insurance can help. For more than a quarter century, we've been serving the North State because it's our home, too. Give us a call at 221-0441 to let us help you review your policies and prepare you for whatever your future holds. Maxwell Insurance, 1378 Hilltop Drive, 221-0441.
From the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
We don't need a lot of new laws to get social justice in America. We need to honor, essentially, the laws we already have. If all men are equal, that is final. It's rest. About the Declaration, there is something that is exceedingly restful. So he brought Americans back to the memory that the foundation of our country had all we need for a good life. Perhaps newer laws are superfluous. Very interesting.
This is your host, Scott Bertram. Welcome to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, part of the Hillsdale College Podcast Network. That was Amity Schles, chair of the Coolidge Foundation and author of Coolidge, Forgotten Man. We'll talk a bit about Calvin Coolidge with her later on in today's program. First, we're joined by Dr. Paul Marino, William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences, and for our purposes today, a big-time baseball fan. It is the middle of winter. We could use a jolt of summer. Also, this past week, January 31st, way back in 1919, Jackie Robinson was born. I thought we'd talk with Dr. Marino about Jackie Robinson, his life, his career, breaking the color barrier in baseball.
Let's talk about that dynamic of it. Brent Rickey, the general manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers, he's the one who decides that the Dodgers are going to integrate. The Dodgers are going to have a black baseball player. What was his reason? Why did he want to do that?
Yeah, that's one of the great sort of disputed questions among historians of the subject. Rickey was such a complicated character. He was a very devout Methodist. He had a sense of Christian brotherhood, which is probably very genuine. He probably saw this as, you know, that segregation was a stain on the American escutcheon, wanted to do something about. He was also a really shrewd and sharp businessman who would, you know, really was a transformative figure in sort of modern Major League Baseball, but basically invented the farm system that turned a small market team like the Cardinals into a powerhouse. But he recognized that blacks were, you know, both the potential to get black players to make your team better so people will come out and see the games, and also to tap into the black audience, that he saw sort of the Negro leagues and the separate sort of captive market which existed in every, you know, segregated market in America as something that he could profit by. And when baseball was interesting, because in 1947, when it integrated, it was really one of the first major American institutions to do so. And baseball at the time, you know, dominated American sports in a way, you know, nothing like it is today, where it really had no competition from professional sports of any other kind. It really was the American pastime. And so integrating that institution probably was more important than a lot of the civil rights legislation that was coming along at the same time. And, you know, baseball had actually been integrated in the 19th century. Technically speaking, there were a couple of brothers, Weldy and Fleetwood Walker in the 19th century, who played for a Toledo team, which was at the time a major league team. Toledo's always been kind of a major league AAA team. And at the behest of the white players, principally, they were driven out of the major leagues. The players forced the owners to first adopt a cap as, you know, one or five black players per team, and then exclude them entirely because the white players wanted to monopolize the jobs in baseball. And since baseball is a monopoly or a cartel, and the only legally, you know, protected one in the United States, they were able to do that.
Jack Robinson, after his military service, plays for the Negro Leagues, Kansas City Monarchs. And he was a very good player, not the best player. Mm-hmm. Satchel Paige, Josh Gibson, you had other players who might have been more talented. So why did Branch Rickey target Jackie Robinson to be this player?
Also, to do that, to do this in Brooklyn at the time, to bring him up through the Dodgers farm system, because, you know, New York had a large black population. Again, the integration of the major leagues almost immediately after the Dodgers integrated, the Cleveland Indians were the first American League team to integrate. And, you know, the American demographic was changing. This is the great migration of the two world wars. Blacks have been moving into American cities in large numbers. And so, you know, it's probably an indication that Rickey was aware of both the talent of black players like Robinson. Again, you had to get, you know, the right ones. He had to, believe it or not, he had to get over the sense that a lot of people had that blacks couldn't play the game as well as whites. People still believe this, even though very quickly, as soon as Major League Baseball integrated, blacks being about 12% of the population reached, you know, more than that proportion of Major League talent. So, you know, just to, Robinson had to prove, just had to show it on the field that blacks were able to play the game as well as whites, when statistically speaking, they were able to play the game better than whites. But that was the popular prejudice that he had to overcome.
Talking with Dr. Paul Marino about Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball. April 15th, 1947, Robinson's first game with the Dodgers as a 28-year-old. He'd win Rookie of the Year in his first year, I think the very first year of the Rookie of the Year award in Major League Baseball. Tell us a little bit, I mean, what kind of a player was Jackie Robinson?
He was a five-tool player, as I say today. I mean, he could do everything. He was an exciting player, too. I mean, the speed on the base paths, especially, and the number of times that he stole home. So that he, I mean, again, he did take the Brooklyn Dodgers, you know, almost overnight, from, you know, a decent team to a, you know, really predominant team, a team that could challenge the Yankees regularly in the postseason. So he did, and again, this is a part of what, Branch Rickey had in mind, that he would improve the quality of the team, it would make the Dodgers contenders and would increase attendance and then, you know, again, the all of the other elements that flow from that. So he did exactly what economists are, say that players should do. He, you know, added marginal value to the Dodgers, much more than what he was being paid by Branch Rickey, or that he would have been paid by anybody else as well. Because this is a period where you still had the reserve clause, which later black players like Curt Flood likened to slavery, in which the best players especially were underpaid relative to what they contributed to the team. And Rickey was a great defender of the reserve clause and was well aware that he was getting more than his money's worth when he signed Jackie Robinson.
Now, just getting to play with the Dodgers and proving himself against other players was not it, because there were other hurdles, right, in terms of travel, in terms of accommodations. Jackie Robinson couldn't stay in the same hotels with the rest of his players, with the rest of his teammates.
Yeah, and although this is sort of Washington and St. Louis would be the only cities that were still in segregated states. Ironically enough, at the time, baseball was almost, you know, still entirely upper, you know, Midwestern and Northeastern. That would have been a bigger problem later on. It would have been a bigger problem in the minor leagues, especially where you had Southern teams. But yes, that was a problem for, of course, you know, diplomats from other countries staying in Washington, D.C. And one of the things that in the 1960s drove the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But baseball was able to do this where they were able to say to, you know, we're not going to play. We're not going to participate in cities that don't respect our players. They had the power to do that.
Robinson, of course, proves to be the right choice. Multiple All-Star, MVP of the league in 1949, ended up winning a World Series in 1956, and I believe his final year in baseball. The Yankees kept getting in their way, the Dodgers.
Yeah, 55, the Dodgers finally won, yes. And yeah. 56, the Yankees took it back.
I was going to ask about his legacy. I think that's relatively clear.
Number 42 has now been retired from every team.
That's right.
There's Jackie Robinson Day, and yeah, he's in many ways, because, you know, sort of dealing with the race problem, which has been the central problem in all of American history, in the thing that, as I said, was the national pastime. The integration of baseball in 1947 really was a milestone in American history.
In post-baseball career for Jackie Robinson, he was very interesting. You know, he became a VP for Chockfull of Nuts Coffee. He became, I believe, the first black national broadcaster for sports, for baseball games, and then died young I believe, the age of 54.
He did die young. And he was also a Republican. He supported the Republican Party, you know, in sort of the Eisenhower years. And that's another good indication of the way in which sort of race relations were in flux in this period, because the Republican Party had been traditionally, you know, the party of Lincoln, and blacks were, you know, voted at pretty much 100% Republican where they could vote up until the New Deal. And then the black vote was in play. Part of what you see going on in baseball, where you had sort of competition for black consumers and for black players, was also taking place in politics in America, where both parties were appealing for the black vote. And that didn't really shake out the way that we know it today until the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Robinson did sort of repudiate the Republican Party late in his life.
Dr. Paul Marino, William and Bernice Grucock Chair in Constitutional History, Professor of History, Dean of Social Sciences, big baseball fan, Yankees fan. Won't hold that against him. Dr. Marino, thanks for joining us here on the Radio Free.
Thanks very much, Hillsdale.
Right. Up next, Amity Schles is with us, Coolidge expert. She wrote a recent essay, Coolidge and Us. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and heard online at KCNR1460.com, has teamed up with the Flag Center and are giving you a chance to win an American flag. And there are two ways to qualify to win a beautiful, high-quality American flag by Ammon. We will be giving them away every Friday morning at 8:15. Now, the first way to qualify is listen weekdays between 7 a.m. and 9 a.m. with Carl and Linda Bott during Free Fire Radio. And they're going to let you know when to call in to qualify at 530-605-4566. And the second way to qualify, check out our Facebook page. Look for the American flag and type your name in the comments. Then, every Friday morning at 8:15, we will draw a winner of a beautiful American flag from the Flag Center at 2124 Hilltop Drive and your friends here at KCNR 96.5 FM, AM 1460, and online at KCNR1460.com.
Now is a great time to prepare for the upcoming wildfire season. REU and city staff are busy clearing vegetation to mitigate wildfire risk to our power lines, facilities, and the community. You can also prepare by trimming back shrubs and tree branches that are closer than 5 feet from your home. Clear debris from your roof and gutter and clear dead vegetation on your property. For information about tree trimming and proximity to power lines, call 530-224-4356. Please remember, we all need to work together to prevent wildfires in our community.
Attention veterans, did you know that Shasta College and Simpson University have veterans resource centers to assist you in your educational pursuits? These centers offer a wide range of support services, including financial aid, tutoring, IT support, and more. We understand the unique challenges that veterans face and are committed to helping you succeed. Our experienced staff is here to help you navigate the college experience and achieve your academic and career goals. Don't let anything stand in your way. This message is brought to you by Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of California Veterans Affairs.
Hi, it's Mark from Hay Humane Society. Are you looking to add to your family? We have puppies, kittens, small critters, and farm animals. Each year we have thousands of amazing animals looking for homes come into our lives, and we hope to have them join yours. Follow us on social media. Find our links on our website, havenhumane.org. Watch our weekly content on YouTube, like our Mark's Monday mashup, when we talk about what's going on and introduce you to our team and adoptable animals. Get involved. Volunteer. Thank you for all your continued support. Together, we are moving closer to our ultimate goal of a North State with no more homeless pets.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice. Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
Hello there, this is Kevin Cry. Every other Sunday, I will be on KCNR, your talk radio, 96.5 FM and 1460 AM. I will be discussing the issues that matter to you most. You'll be able to call in directly, ask questions, and have a dialogue open and free every other Sunday right here on KCNR, your talk radio.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Be sure to check out the Hillsdale College Podcast Network at podcast.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Amity Schles. She is chair of the Coolidge Foundation. You can find more about them at coolidgefoundation.org. Also the author of the great book, Coolidge, Forgotten Man. You can find a recent essay at nationalreview.com. Calvin Coolidge and us. Amity, thanks so much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Your book is called Forgotten Man, and this essay we're going to talk about today essentially runs to the point of Coolidge is being overlooked once again. I'm sure you're asked very often, but what is it about the man and his presidency that so often causes us to forget about him?
Americans like war presidents, and we believe war defines the presidency. Woodrow Wilson went into the war as a peace domestic policy person, and he became a war president. And that is, by and large, how we remember Woodrow Wilson. He negotiated World War One. Our memory of Franklin Roosevelt, who served many peacetime years, is defined by his leadership in World War Two. He won the war. All else is forgiven, or all else is, looks pretty good. People don't rate Roosevelt, that would be Franklin, except for in terms of the war, really. Even when they rate him economically, they do that with an eye to the victories in Europe and Asia. So Coolidge was a peacetime president. He began service in 23. He left office in early 29. It makes him less exciting, and we have a kind of problem with the way we look at presidents, which is we rank them as if they were a sports team. And therefore, when one moves up, it's zero sum. Someone else has to move down. So when war presidents are moved up, Coolidge automatically moves down in the slot ranking of presidents. And that, therefore, perhaps puts him lower than he deserves to be. Because, of course, the job of the president, that which we should be ranking them on, includes the non-war challenges, the stewardship domestically of the president, as opposed to how a man performed if he did as commander-in-chief.
The theme of the essay, one of the themes of the essay, is how Coolidge has had navigated challenges like we face today, but perhaps we first talk about how he became who he became. You say in the piece that three accidents of his early career turned him toward conservative constitutionalism. What were those accidents, and how do they influence Coolidge and his thinking and philosophy?
Well, absolutely, and this is very important for Hillsdale, particularly, where a university that does pay attention to this kind of thing to the benefit of its culture and students. Normally, Republicans, for example, speak of Coolidge in favor of his tax cuts, which were tremendous for the U.S. economy, or other sort of technical achievements. But what I argue in this essay is that he was only able to pursue policy such as fiscal policy because of his view of the U.S. Constitution. And the three accidents were, one, let's say that Coolidge's constitutional philosophy was conservative. He didn't believe the executive was king. He was rather a presider in George Washington's sense. What made Coolidge able to believe that in a relatively modern time? One, he did not go to law school. And in law school, even then, at Harvard, where he would have gone, or Columbia, where he would have gone, judges were becoming more important. That is, they were becoming deciders, not just raters, of cases. And there was the new progressive culture was changing. The teaching of law lifting the sights of lawyers instead of just writing wills. Lawyers were now supposed to change America, making them more, frankly, like ministers, that is, preachers and politicians. Coolidge missed that because he didn't go to law school. He read law, as Abraham Lincoln had. His dad thought, this is awful expensive. I didn't even go to college myself. You can read law at my friend's office here in Vermont. His father was well known in Vermont and friendly with the political leaders and in the state house from time to time himself. And Coolidge said, no, I'll read law in Massachusetts, near where I went to college in Northampton, Mass., and then I'll sit the bar. But Coolidge did go the old-fashioned way and therefore missed the powerful culture of law school. And that's the first accident. The second accident, let's see, the second accident was that he entered politics from the bottom. He did not go to Davos before he ran for president. He did not go to, he didn't go to Versailles to write the treaty at the end of World War I, as did his friend Dwight Morrow, who had been with him at Amherst. He was a little politician in a little town, and also a little practicing attorney, small-town attorney in Northampton, Massachusetts, which he called a city, by the way, and which was an extraordinarily exciting city in the day. It's not just where Smith College happens to be. So he encountered real businesses with real problems. At that time, there were many immigrant businesses in western Massachusetts, and he became their lawyer because when you're a young lawyer and you're looking for clients, who do you find? The people who are so new, they don't have a lawyer yet.
Right.
So he worked with many immigrants, German brewers, Irish people, people who founded new banks. That gave him an understanding for the challenges of day-to-day business that you would never have if you went from graduate school to graduate school and then to government.
Talking with Amity Schles about Calvin Coolidge, these three happy accidents. What about the third, Amity?
The third accident was T.R., Theodore Roosevelt. In that period, Coolidge was a Republican. His family were Republicans. They had a sense of loyalty. Coolidge once said, kind of wryly, if nobody is partisan, nobody can be independent. That is, you free-riding independents who act as though you have more claim on morality than we cogs within the party are only able to make that claim because we are loyal. He believed in party loyalty and working behind the scenes. And what he observed, so Coolidge was born in 1872. So, you know, he was in his 30s watching ER in his 20s. You know, ER was president when he was a young man, observing TR. In 1912, TR, out of office, decided out of vanity to go back and run again as an independent bull moose, wrecked the Republican Party's prospects, even in Massachusetts, Coolidge's state, where he was running for office, which had been a Republican stronghold. So TR betrayed his party with that election with a real political consequence. As a result, it was a three-party race, 1912. The main parties, there were three. And the Democrat won. The other side won, and put through progressive measures about which Coolidge was increasingly skeptical. He saw the costs of flamboyant populist leadership, and that made Coolidge all the more cautious when it came time for him to serve as U.S. president a bit later.
We'll pause right there. Amity Schles with us, Coolidge expert, her essay at nationalreview.com, Coolidge and Us. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
The National Wild Turkey Federation's 25th Annual Reading Chapter Hunting Heritage Banquet is Saturday, March 9th at the Shasta District Fairgrounds. To purchase tickets for the event, or if you would like more information, contact Candy Muse at 530-526-8350. That's 530-526-8350. Or online at nwtf.org/event. Sponsored by Johnny Morris Bass Pro Shops, Cabela's, Benelli, Hoyt Harness Company, La Crosse, Sportsman's Guide, and Tacticam.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. Do you have a crazy schedule and can't seem to get to a class to qualify for your CCW, CCW renewal, or maybe learn to use that new firearm you just purchased? Consider a private class with NFI. Learn to shoot a handgun, rifle, shotgun, or even a BB gun. Classes are taught by an instructor that you choose on your dates and location. Give NFI a call at 530-999-1822 or visit us online at usgunpro.com. This is Ted Leidy, and I'll see you at the range.
Your vacation is over, but the worst part, the long drive home from Sacramento. Unless you chose to fly from Redding, at Redding Regional Airport, your takeoff and landing are close to home, with quick check-ins and nonstop flights to San Francisco, Seattle, Los Angeles, and Burbank. You can travel the world with one connection on United, Alaska, or Avelo Airlines. Next time, skip the drive to and from Sacramento. Fly with ease and convenience from Redding Regional Airport.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Every day, your life is filled with choices. And when a health crisis happens, you need to be prepared to choose the best healthcare partner. That's when Shasta Regional Medical Center is there to answer the call above the rest. Ranked best in Reading and in the nation for patient safety and clinical excellence, you can be confident that when you choose Shasta, you are choosing superior care, safety, and excellence for you and your family. Choose Shasta at ShastaRegional.com.
30 years ago, Simpson University arrived in Reading with a promise to serve the North State. Warmly welcomed by this far Northern California community, we forged lasting partnerships, serving our neighbors locally as well as globally. Building on our promise, Simpson University now offers over 20 degree programs. Our promise to be the gateway to world service begins in our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
I'm celebrating local heroes. Tune in the second Thursday each month at 6.05 p.m. right after the news for Heroes of the North State on North State Now. I'm Michelle Slade. During North State Now, we will speak with your neighbors, friends, family, and community members who give back, not to be recognized, but because it's the right thing to do. During these conversations, we will learn what truly makes our community and the people in it. Join me the second Thursday of each month at 6.05 p.m., right after the news, for Heroes of the North State on North State Now.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We've been talking with Ebony Schlaes, chair of the Coolidge Foundation, author of Coolidge, Forgotten Man. You can find more at CoolidgeFoundation.org, her recent essay at NationalReview.com, Coolidge and Us. Ebony, a couple of years after that 1912 election, Calvin Coolidge became president of the state Senate, and he delivers a speech known as Have Faith in Massachusetts, and you call it one of the finest elucidations of federalism in existence. That's a big claim. What was this speech about, and what made it so unique in laying out the tenets of federalism?
Have Faith was a reaction to what was going on. Massachusetts was a powerhouse of progressivism, and Coolidge didn't like it that much. He was, you know, the GOP, his party was progressive, but he didn't like it that much. So finally, he got the opportunity of this speech, Have Faith in Massachusetts. And he said, men do not make laws, they do but discover them. Whoa, that means our job is finding laws that already exist and implementing them, that is principles, in a way that is respectful. That's very different from we will change America through our own brilliant vision. Another thing he said was, I'm trying to think of the quote, but he said something to the effect that you can't help the weak by pulling down the strong. Class warfare is not productive. It does, it might be fun and serve political productivity, but it doesn't serve the polity. You can't help, don't expect to help the weak by pulling down the strong. Those are two of the lines that stand out. So he's, why is that constitutionally going back to the fathers who also saw limits to presidential power because they knew there was a power behind the presidency under which men lived, which was the power of God, the power of the divine, and that we on earth dare not do too much and take ourselves for gods. This was a real challenge, this speech to not only TR, but progressives in Coolidge's state, such as Louis Brandeis, who was now already in Washington, but was a big reformer and said, man must change everything. And Coolidge also, I think the limits of government in this, as displayed in the speech, are the most constitutional part of it.
Amity, in the limited time we have together, we need to hop forward toward Coolidge's time as president. And you say a few times in this piece at National Review how often Coolidge points back toward the founders, points back toward the Declaration of Independence. How are Coolidge's successes in the White House directly influenced by those two things, the founders and the Declaration?
Well, the humility of the founders is evident in Coolidge's humility. When Warren Harding, the president, died, Coolidge became president, and he didn't say, I will define a new program, as if he were Lyndon Johnson, Great Society in Michigan. He said, I will follow the orders I received. So the mandate that we have is a mandate given us by the people in the 1920 election because of their reflecting their enthusiasm for the 1920 GOP platform. So I will execute. And when you are clearly operating in service rather than in the, of the polity and the agreement, the contract with America, rather than your own, in service of your own aggrandizement, people give you their political support. He got a lot of political credit because he had the humility of George Washington, and that enabled him to pass his tax cuts, which are dramatic. You know, in the Harding Coolidge period, as a result of commitment to that platform and commitment to the economy, our tax rate went from the 70% range to 25%, which is lower than Ronald Reagan. But you believe a man who clearly has committed himself to service rather than, I don't know, a fop, a party vain person. And so Coolidge won his bet. Traditional federalism worked. He gave a wonderful speech, which is important, and I know taught at Hillsdale, about the Constitution in 26, in which he said, we don't need a lot of new laws to get social justice in America. We need to honor, essentially, the laws we already have. If all men are equal, that is final. It's restful. About the Declaration, there is something that is exceedingly restful. So he brought Americans back to the memory that the foundation of our country had all we need for a good life. Perhaps newer laws are superfluous. Very interesting. And African Americans, for example, did fare better in the 20s. So the rate of, if you go into the data, you'll see the rate of lynching went down dramatically in the 20s. Why? Because the economy was better and because people were less angry.
Huh.
But it, I'll just say one more thing. Coolidge's final action as president didn't relate to economic policy or anything like that, but it was a policy decision and certainly affected the country greatly and restored a burnished presidency to respect. He could have run again in 28, but he chose not to,
right,
like George Washington, because a president is merely a presider. And as you said, it's better to change presidents from time to time. Otherwise, and here I paraphrase, the president becomes like a monarch and the presidency like a monarchy. And that was an important legacy for us. He showed that one could act as Washington did, who also, of course, chose not to run again, even in an era with telephones, automobiles, and newspapers. So that was amazing.
Ebony Schlaes with us. She is chair of the Coolidge Foundation. You can find more at coolidgefoundation.org. It seems like people, when they think of Coolidge, are pretty broken into two camps. Either they have not heard of him and don't know much about him at all, or they have and they love him deeply. What would you say about Coolidge, perhaps particularly how it pertains to our politics today, that might reach those people somewhere in the middle of those two extremes?
Well, we know today that we feel this, that politicians disappoint us.
Mm-hmm.
We watch a debate and we say, I don't like this candidate. And the real reason is the politicians appear to be not good men, but opportunists. And the media encourages that aspect of the politicians. The media say, that won't fly. I'll use it as an example. This is not an endorsement, but I'll use an example. Mike Pence really adores Coolidge and had his portrait in his office. Mike Pence has gone through things. He's been a governor and he's been a vice president in a very difficult period. He's a kind of profile in courage, as we say. But they say, the media will say, and then the voters follow that, he can't win. He's a loyalist. But actually, we value loyalists. Our media discourage loyalists. They look at politics as sort of some sports game. But that's what's going on. So those who understand that people are loyal, and Pence was loyal, again, to constitutional principle, not party, those loyalists, that we want to be loyal in that way. So that's, those who appreciate Coolidge do that. The media tell us that first impression matters most. When parties train new candidates, they haul them off to a resort and lecture them on the importance of the first impression. Coolidge was a third impression person. When you first met him, he seemed insignificant. He didn't talk. He wasn't a big man. He didn't smile. And people came to love him through experience. He wasn't a used car dealer who got you once and you never go back. That is still valued by Americans. We just need sort of to support our intuitive understanding more culturally. And Coolidge had that. And he's loved because he was a third impression person, because he validated the idea that we rate people on their whole lives, not on some snapshot.
Ebony Schlaes, you can read her essay at nationalreview.com. Calvin Coolidge and Us. Also, find out more about the Coolidge Foundation at coolidgefoundation.org and her wonderful book, Coolidge, Forgotten Man. Ebony, thank you so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Up next, we talk with D.G. Hart, professor of history here at Hillsdale College, as we continue our series on H.L. Mencken. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Friends, RC here, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor, the Diesel Vintage. A smooth burn, a perfect draw, and flavor for days. This is what an expertly crafted Parejo from the farms of A.J. Fernandez offers us. The Diesel Vintage is everything we seek in a fine and exceptional cigar experience. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, Redding, California.
KCNR invites you to join us the second Friday of the month, starting at 8 a.m., for the Gorman Law Hour, featuring local attorney Patrick Gorman, a legal expert when it comes to injured workers, compensation claims, and employee claims. So, if you have a legal question or just wonder whether or not you have a legal issue or problem, talk to Patrick Gorman, attorney at law, during the Gorman Law Hour, starting at 8 a.m. the second Friday of the month on KCNR.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. but Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
This is Carl Bott. Join Linda and me Monday through Friday from 7 to 9 a.m. for Free Fire Radio right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio. We're going to discuss what's happening in our city, county, state, and nation. Join in. Miss a day, miss a lot. Free Fire Radio, Monday through Friday, 7 to 9 a.m.
What is happening in the state of Jefferson? To find out, listen to the Jefferson State of Mind program Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. on KCNR with your hosts Wayne Carpenter and Terry Raposa. To catch up on past broadcasts or to listen anytime, go to KCNR1460.com and click on the archives link.
ACA, come out and play. Have you seen the bill we all have to pay? The time has come for 51 in a Jefferson State of Mind.
Hillsdale.edu. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of this program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu, click on subscribe, and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined by D.G. Hart. He is Associate Professor of History here at Hillsdale College. Dr. Hart, thanks for joining us.
Great to be back with you.
Continuing our conversations on H.L. Mencken, Dr. Hart's also written a book on Mencken, Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. We talked today about free speech and Mencken's proponents of free speech. Why was he such a fierce advocate of free speech? Why did he think it was so important for society?
Well, part of it goes to his ambivalent relationship to the United States. He's very critical of America in many ways, American people, critical of democracy, and maybe one of his worst books is Notes on Democracy. I think it's something like that. It doesn't hold up very well compared to some of his other books. Having said all that, he was a firm defender of the Constitution, especially the Bill of Rights. And as a writer and as an editor, he saw that as basic. And it's hard for us to remember a time when there were obscenity laws still in the books. There were also activist groups that tried to prevent the circulation of material in the presses that they could use various government restrictions or even mail service to have get their ends for their own purposes. And Mencken, highly aware of those sorts of restrictions, also Mencken being an agnostic, he was not an atheist. He said that would require too much certainty. But being an agnostic, he was up against a culture that was overwhelmingly Protestant, and Protestants, the so-called Protestant establishment, did run a large part of American institutions. Again, not with some kind of government sanction, but informally, they were very prominent, and Mencken thought of himself as an outsider. And I do believe that those legal protections that came with the Bill of Rights, the Constitution, was one way that he knew that he could sort of get through and be heard and help other people to be heard.
In 1926, he purposefully gets himself arrested in Boston trying to sell copies of the American Mercury in protest of policies that were laid out. What was his issue at the time with the Watch and Ward Society, and what was he trying to accomplish?
Well, the Watch and Ward Society objected to a short story in the American Mercury. I'm pretty sure it was a short story, not a journalistic report. The Mercury had a combination of both. And this is a guy who was named after one of the leading Methodists in the United States. His name was Asbury, was in the name of the author. But it was about a small town and there was a prostitute in the town who would regularly service men in the town after Sunday evenings in the cemetery next to the church. And Protestants and others objected to this. This was going outside the lines. I've read the story. There's nothing inherently, especially by today's standards, objectionable mm-hmm. about it. But in that climate, it was certainly racy. Even to write about prostitution, acknowledge it's out there and trying, maybe presenting the person somewhat sympathetically. So they wanted to shut it down. And the way they did that was to stop circulation in the mail. And Mencken's magazine had a second class status. And if you were not regular in keeping your postage every month, you would lose that second class status and maybe have to bump up to first, which would mm-hmm. be much more expensive. And so they were that was one of the ways that they were trying to restrict this. And Mencken wanted to try to get this through the courts as quickly as possible, try to get the magazine back out in circulation as quickly as possible. So it was dicey because it looked like they might actually succeed in stopping the publication. There was another effort the following issue to try to restrict it, but Mencken was able to get through and prevail. Through the courts, I think a judge finally interceded and said that the Watch and Ward Society's restrictions were illegitimate.
You mentioned that Mencken's agnostic. It seems that Mencken viewed religion as a barrier to freedom of speech and was particularly critical of Puritanism. What was his thinking?
Well, he used Puritanism as a stand-in word for the Protestant establishment. And it's somewhat ironic because Puritanism did not become the kind of study that mid-20th century Harvard, Yale academics would turn into a cottage industry in literary studies, in American history, colonial history, intellectual history. Puritans, as I mentioned, I think in the previous episode, Perry Miller was responsible for that. And Perry Miller had grown up reading the American Mercury and knew Mencken's take on the Puritans. And it wasn't simply in reaction to Mencken, but he did try to improve Puritanism, and he was very successful. Miller was very successful in doing that. But again, I think Mencken associated Puritanism with this Protestant world that elevated moralism over aesthetics. That mm-hmm. was particularly galling to him when he did literary criticism. And there is some legitimacy in attributing to Puritanism because the Northeast establishment, intellectual establishment, the universities associated with the Ivy League, these institutions did in some ways trace their lineage back to the Puritans. So he was probably partly correct in looking at it that way, although at times it really got away from him as well.
Talking with Dr. D.G. Hart about H.L. Mencken and his views on free speech, Mencken is perhaps best known or very well known for reporting on the Scopes trial in 1925. What were his views of the trial, his motivations behind covering it? Is there a free speech angle there?
Yes, very much so. He didn't care for the laws in Tennessee that were restricting teaching what he would have called basic science. And it was. I mean, by 1925, Darwinism has been around for over 50 years. The reasons why people opposed Darwinism, which I don't think Mencken acknowledged as much, were partly had to do with eugenics, and the survival of the fittest could very easily be used to keep inferior people from reproducing. And that was certainly what was going on. And if you look at the textbook that John T. Scopes was using, that ironically enough, I think the state legislature had to approve, eugenics were in that. And William Jennings Bryan, who was the lead prosecutor, was very much an anti-eugenics guy and gets a lot of credit these days from even liberal, progressive, somewhat radical historians for taking that stand. But Mencken was concerned about states restricting scientific views, so that was one level of it. But also, I don't know the sequence of when he knew that William Jennings Bryan was going to be the lead prosecutor, but he detested Bryan. One of the worst things I think Mencken ever wrote, where I think his bile just got away from him and wasn't funny. Bryan died 5 days after the trial, and Mencken wound up writing an article which functioned as a kind of obituary, and it's one of the meanest things he ever wrote. The man wasn't even cold yet, and he was going off like this, but there was something about Brian, his appeal to the masses, Brian stood for a kind of the populism and the worst sides of democracy in Mencken's mind. So I think that was another reason for going after this. If people like Brian were associated with it, he wanted to be against it.
Did he believe in or have any idea about principled limitations of free speech, or would we call him what we say these days as a free speech absolutist?
I think absolutist, at least up to the point of yelling fire in a crowded theater, those sorts of things. He thought there were so many cockamamie ideas out by various reformers of different stripes, whether it was sex, food, drink. He saw it all. And this was in an era when science was becoming the sort of thing that people followed. You got to follow the science. And he mocked that stuff all the time. But I had no sense that he wanted to shut it down. He just kind of thought this was part of the human experience, as part of the nature of American society, and let people find out what the truth is by seeing all sides.
Dr. D.G. Hart, Associate Professor of History at Hillsdale College, also the author of the book Damning Words, The Life and Religious Times of H.L. Mencken. Dr. Hart, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
You're welcome.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Paul Marino from Hillsdale, talking about Jackie Robinson, Amity Schles on Calvin Coolidge, and D.G. Hart from Hillsdale's History Department on H.L. Mencken. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at podcast.hillsdale.edu or wherever you get your audio. The assistant producer of the show is Sam Lair. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Do you have something you'd like to get painted? Then bring it to Victory Powder Coating. Powder coating is a durable, colorful, environmentally friendly alternative to paint. It's useful in automotive, agricultural, decorative, and high-temperature applications. Victory Powder Coating has become the North State leader in powder coating applications and metal finishing. They specialize in large industrial items like truck beds, agricultural equipment, and trailers. They're dedicated to providing superior work and outstanding customer care. Consider Victory Powder Coating for your next project. Victory Powder Coating.
Welcome to the Queen of Dragons Dispensary, your ultimate destination for top-notch cannabis experiences. Conveniently located at 5044 Shasta Dam Boulevard, Shasta Lake, our locally owned and operated dispensary takes pride in providing you with the best in price, value, and safety. Rest easy knowing that all of our products are rigorously tested for your peace of mind. We champion medical freedom, empowering you to choose what's right for you. Unbelievable value for unbeatable quality. For exclusive deals and exciting updates, don't forget to follow us on Twitter at the Queen Dragons or visit www.queenofdragons.com. The Queen of Dragons Dispensary, where the fire of quality meets the freedom of choice. Backed by popular demand, fresh and local flower powered by Pinnacle, Shasta County's premier local cultivator. Package fresh and daily with a wide variety and best prices and deals in town. And they can package larger sizes and quantities on site. Available only at the Queen of Dragons Dispensary. Winter hours are Monday through Sunday, 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. and they deliver. 530-276-9771.
This is Carl Bott and Ted Leidy. We want to invite you to our new show, Man Up, the fourth Thursday of each month, right here on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
Man Up, 6 to 7 p.m., where we explore the lost art of being a man.
Spirits, cigars, and hit the ground running when you get up in the morning. That's what Man Up's going to be about.
Oh, don't forget motorcycles, guns, and hard work every day.
And those things that men talk about when women aren't around.
That's right. Even cooking sometimes.
Even cooking sometimes. People, places, and things.
Serving your family, your community, and your country.
Man Up. Fourth Thursday of each month from 6 to 7 p.m. right here on Free Fire Radio.
Join Tolkien's radio show every Sunday at 2 p.m. on 96.5 FM and AM 1460 as host Christy Matthews and Linda Kent explore the exciting world of cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. Learn how Bitcoin is revolutionizing finance and grasp sound money principles. Hear new perspectives on achieving financial freedom beyond broken institutions. The future of money is here. Empower yourself with knowledge. Listen to Tolkien's radio show with Linda and Christy this Sunday at 2 p.m. on KCNR. Big and exciting changes are underway.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.